always imagine my sermon that I've written before as I imagine these candles. One of the questions that gets asked in the sermon, which I'll start in just a second, is why do we still need to have a we? And I think today's joys and sorrows are probably the answer to that whole question. But you still get 20 minutes of a sermon because I wrote it. So I want to think back to ancient times. Humans would form in bands, no matter what they did. Sometimes they were, you think of them as tribes or clans. And in those days, we want to think of we in quotation marks, we just had an obvious meaning. It was everybody you knew, everyone you could name, and folks that were pretty much like you, maybe different ages, different experiences, but at the end of the day, there was a commonality. When deciding what to do next, there was only really one question. Where will we go? Because going it alone, whether you're making a physical move or just making some other change, the concept back then of following your personal bliss, or the idea of listening to your own drummer and venturing out, really made no sense. Separating from what you knew was just point blank too dangerous. The survival meant that we were needed to secure food and shelter together. And so even though we was clear, you shouldn't be picturing summer camp here. There was conflict and disagreement and anger and passion in any group. And in time, there were some patterns of culture that evolved where they knew some of the stories that needed to be passed down from the generations in hopes that somebody might not make the same mistake so that they could work through some of these conflicts and challenges. They also created rituals around what do you do to welcome the birth of a new child? What do you do to change your family at a time of marriage? What are the rituals that make space, can deal with lamentation, can deal with grief and loss? And this we, even though they knew everybody, they needed rules and penalties for breaking the rules, and eventually they needed to figure out what you do with conflicts with neighboring groups. So even though we was clear, it kept taking on new meaning. So 25 years ago, it was actually a little more than 25 years ago, in Chestertown, Maryland, as mentioned earlier, several moms, Pat and Leslie, were looking for a place of moral inspiration and shared learning for their children in times and wanted to put some stakes in the ground. There was no physical building at that point, but there was some wanting of a slightly different we. There was some gap in the existing community, in a community that was a little bit more amorphous to define, and they were saying, what do we do now? Do we need to actually form a group? That's just a question that our ancestors wouldn't have had. They knew who we was, but they were struggling to cope with other things. They were struggling to cope with the mysteries of nature and suffering. And these moms had plenty of information. They had plenty of science, and they had TV around them and early parts of the internet. It wasn't that they were lacking or trying to feel exactly what you need to do with those mysteries. What our founders of this congregation didn't know when they were finding it, and they were trying to figure out why they needed to find a place to describe values. They couldn't predict 9/11, 17 years ago. They couldn't predict smartphones in everybody's hand, and yet they still took a gamble. They went and gleaned some future. And part of gleaning a future, trying to imagine a future, is what it takes to act. So do we still need a we? I'm going to preface this sermon on yes, hearing joys and sorrows, because I think each time you have to make a decision about where to go next, you need to think about who you're going to go there with. we can try to imagine that if everybody here just used their common sense and headed out where they thought they needed to go, it would all work out well. But I think there is a sense that we need each other. In ancient times, the pace of change differed. But these communities also needed to move. They moved physically for better farming, for greater safety. They improved their practices. They looked at their rituals. And each time you do that, each time you change something that's stable in your life, it means there's loss. And as the changes were made, some of them forced and some of them by choice, they were together. But who would make those choices? Because I think that's a harder question when you're thinking about leadership. Who would do that guessing about the future? Because a lot about guessing about the future is being able to name where you are right now. Who's going to set forward a vision? Who's going to say, generally, I think we need to go over here? So when Pat and Leslie started something rolling toward being a Unitarian something, and as I understand the stories, they didn't have a lot of depth of families that had grown up for 40 years being Unitarians, but yet there were folks that supported them, like Reverend Dan Higgins from Easton, and in time, Peter Tapke, and they got advice. There were early members who were willing to make decisions. And make no mistake, the vision and the ideas were half-baked. I say half-baked in love. And the honor and the courage it takes to move based on predictions and uncertainty. Few possibilities get to be made with full information. Full decisions about where you're going to go next are made that way. But somehow, when you move toward that uncertainty, if you do it as we, I think it still makes sense in modern times. There has to be some trust in one another, a belief in the whole. And there even has to be a championing of what may not have been your first choice, but what you came to adopt as the vision of we. And it starts with some preliminary vision. It doesn't start with a perfect one, but the reason you put a vision out there is in part so it will be questioned, to test the shape of the vision, because I will guarantee you the leaders who are making those choices are already afraid. But they're looking around to say, how am I going to get followers? Do I need to tweak the direction? Who are the other leaders? Who are the other folks that could pick up a part of the task? In these ancient times, they had people that actually got names for this. They were sort of the visionaries and the prophets and the oracles. And there were a few folks that were reading tea leaves and just sort of pulling down some wild stuff. But frankly, the prophets that got listened to, whether they thought they were hearing it from God or they were going with their gut feeling, is when they could do something where folks could say, yeah, I think that basically makes sense. I never thought we'd go there, but I can get it. So prediction is one part of vision. But here's the harder part. A prophet in those times also needed to be a messenger. Prophets were in the education and persuasion business. If there was going to be some we, and the we was going to change course, the leaders and the followers needed to trust that the message made sense. It was directionally sound. And being in the prophet business back in the day was hard. Few like to hear what might come, and a change in course invariably meant bucking current systems, bucking leadership, bucking power centers that needed to change. And to change those norms was risky. In 1990, in Kent County, there was no Unitarian Universalist community. Now there's been one for 25 years. And the math there is the 1993. I kept going 25 years, the first service in 1992. As you tell the story, 1993 is used as your founding year because that is the year that on the floor of the General Assembly, Dan Higgins went and presented you as one of the very few new congregations that were formed. And that became the birthday year. And this we that is you, has been claimed around your identity of shared values. There's been this coming and going, as we talked about, of individual members, yet there is this strong sense of who you are. There's comfort as you gather. There's narrative of how you've weathered varying bumps and summer programs and how this building got built. And it's a great story, and I hope not only the folks that raised their hand for 20 years and more, but I hope everyone, charging you guys because you're representing all new members, can learn to tell the story of this congregation. It's on the website. But it's not 1990. It's 2018. So what is the world today? You're a prophet. What is the world you name today that you can base your next vision on? Because the really good prophets, their best thing they do is they could explain where the community was at its current point. What has changed that feels important as this congregation continues to chart its course? Margaret Wheatley is an author. I think of her sort of an anthropologist. She does a lot of consulting work. And she recently wrote a book called Who Do We Choose to Be? She names some of the realities of our times and future, and frankly, she's harsh. Her own look at history and data leads her to a premise that our society has reached a point where we can't solve these big, complex issues at a global level. It's just not working. She actually has some really strong language pointing to where we might be in the decline of some big civilization. Things of in big years. And she takes a tough look, which is what prophets need to do. And I don't know, is she right? Maybe. But here's where I found her work prophetic. We are wherever we are, and some of those truths may resound. But by turning away from holding too much hope in global solutions and these really big problems, Wheatley calls for turning to local communities and leading locally. She notes, this world needs leaders. We need leaders who put service over self, who can be steadfast through crisis and failures, who want to stay present and make a difference to the people and situations they care about. Now it's up to us, not as global leaders, but as local leaders. We can lead people to create positive changes locally that make life easier, more sustainable, and create possibility. Let's use the power we have to do that and the resources that are already available. And when Wheatley, who consults, she's consulted with groups of nuns. She did some really interesting work with groups that were being dismissed by some of the hierarchies and some of the churches. She's done some amazing work through the Army and looking at how they teach some of the Army young officers coming up. How do you make decisions in the field with the information you have where you can't keep going back to some hierarchy? What do we learn about local power in these situations? And when Wheatley does her consulting work, she asks this question. Who do you choose to be for this time? Are you willing to use whatever power and influence you have to create islands of sanity that evoke and rely on our best human qualities to create and produce and persevere? Islands of sanity. And Wheatley is not talking about creating an island in this building. That's not how she thinks of local community. She does not think of islands that end at these walls of this sanctuary. She asks us to look at the quality of relationships in this work of local leadership. And she asks this, If you were to create a trend line, and again, I ask you to think of we beyond these walls, but somewhat locally. If you were to create a trend line from a few years ago to now, and a few years ahead, how are people relating to each other? Has trust increased or decreased? Are people more self-protective or less? Are they willing to be there for one another? And for my data managers in the audience, I don't know if you're there, she asks, what's the evidence for any of your conclusions? She asks us to rate a community toward our reaction. Where are we on the spectrum between love and fear? Are we helping folks deal with fear? Are we helping build from that local center? When Wheatley looks at the global situation, she keeps going, but we keep running into roadblocks one after another. There are patterns that aren't working when we try to solve these big, huge, nationwide or worldwide problems. And I wonder how the ancients might have heard these questions she asks, or this observation she makes. When a paradigm no longer provides guidance for how to live in the world, the most common response is to grasp it and hold on more firmly. As it dawns on us that we don't know how things work, that it's not working, we become more insistent that it just has to work the way we thought it did. Opening to uncertainty, to the need for a new way of seeing, is not what humans do well. We use our big brains and our powers of cognition to resist change. Our skills at manipulating information lead us to become more fundamentalist and certain in our views. And I love this line. It didn't work before, but at least we know how to do it that way. So let's do it again. So that's some broad context on the future. But for this congregation over the last year, you've been creating a new vision. The board charged a group to lead this effort, and the group, this vision team, this mission team, has done amazing work. They asked the questions of group identity. They asked those important questions prophets need of who are we? And they invited you into the conversation. They looked outside these walls for context and for the challenges of our time. They looked for what might be possible. The group, this missioning and visioning group, they met and met. They told stories. They tried to imagine what might be next, not to declare or to dive into the details of how to implement it, but to invite more into the work of the future. Because they've been oracles. They are prophets in a way, and their biggest job, remember, the prophets had two jobs. Imagine the future, and then the messaging. And these folks were charged to message via PowerPoint, and they did it well. There's a wonderful PowerPoint summarizing their thoughts. And I am excited. I really am. I've shared this with many people beyond belief on the work that this group did. You may hear it as the strategic planning group, but I just do want those folks, I think they're all here now, Carl included, to stand, and just so folks can know who you are as we go through this next couple paragraphs. Here's why I'm excited. They've done the plan. The board, we heard the plan in August, and I'm sure for me at least, I have more questions as I let the plan soak in. It's not something that you just jump into and say, I'm going to follow that next change without shaping it a bit, making it your own, and understanding what's behind some of the possibilities. Why was some parts written really open-ended? Why are some parts more specific? It's a vision that takes us to being a place that looks at the divisions in the world and local community seriously. It's a shift to both continue what's been done, but to be more outward facing. Yes, there's a call to keep gathering and to do that well and to care for one another, but there's also a place to shift our lens. How can we be a place to examine the price of racial inequity to each of us, to understand that our own destiny is a mutual destiny with so many others? It's a fresh understanding of how we can connect across generations and hear from those in early adulthood and from children and youth who are negotiating a world that is very different than the world of the 1960s, the 1970s, different than the world of the 1980s and the world of the 1990s when this congregation was formed. They may not become we through joining as members, though some might, but there is a we that we need to be in relationship with, to be addressing fears, to be addressing the ways we connect. So yes, I am a cheerleader for this plan and the process to move it to the next step, which is in the broadsheet. There's a chance for everybody to see the presentation. And I just encourage folks to make this your plan, not to be a place that it's just a document that came through this congregation. This is a place that has been built on love for 25 years, and it has amazing potential to continue to help strengthen relationships in a world that is very complex and needs the local care and compassion we can offer one another. I'm pretty sure if those ancients had had PowerPoint, they would have used it. And when you talk to folks, when you ask questions, those folks who just stood, please offer them your gratitude. And so I close with words from Margaret Wheatley, called Turning to One Another. There is no power greater than a community discovering what it cares about. Ask, what is possible, not what's wrong, and keep asking. Notice what you care about. Assume that many others share your dreams. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters and talk to people you know. Talk to people you don't know. Talk to people you never talk to. Be intrigued by the differences you hear. Expect to be surprised. Treasure curiosity more than certainty. Invite in everybody who cares to work on what's possible and acknowledge that everyone is an expert in something. Know that creative solutions come from new connections. And remember, you don't fear people whose story you know. Real listening always brings people closer together. Trust that meaningful conversations can change your world, and rely on human goodness. Stay together. So in celebration of this community and the vision that took you to this point, trust that that will bring you forward. And to the extent I can be a part of that, I am very grateful. May it be so.